disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't been turned.
Welcome to This Is America, August 19th, 2018. We have two very important interviews for you today. First, we talk with longtime investigative journalist Greg Palast, who for years who has written about voter suppression and stolen elections. In 2016, Palast attempted to break into the American mainstream by covering a story of a program being used in some states by Republicans entitled CrossCheck. The system was fairly simple. It simply checked to see if, for say, Jose Hernandez was also a registered voter in more than one state. The Republican Party would then send out a mailer to the person's house to verify their information, and in many cases, sometimes up to 90%, it was simply thrown away as junk mail. In this way, in the 2016 election, in some areas, millions of people, largely African American Latino voters, were purged from the voting rolls. The man behind this push, Chris Kobach, comes out of a legal arm of the white nationalist think tank FAIR, Federation for American Immigration Reform, who we here at It's Going Down have covered at length. Fast forward to 2018, and Chris Kobach, with strong ties to the Trump administration, as Greg Palast discusses, has now begun to help other Republicans engage in cross-check campaigns in their own states, including many of the recent cases involving African-American voters who you may have heard about on the news. And look, to be real, while we here at IGD rep that red and black as autonomous and anarchists, we believe that the working class should never get up rights won through struggle, and that we see the recent attempts by Republicans to remove literally millions of voters of color as what they are, a blatant racist attack on a broad section of the working class that is designed to keep in power a gang of unpopular pro-Trump bureaucrats. As Ami Du Radical recently wrote on It's Going Down, this is why the Kavanaugh confirmation was so vital to the GOP, and why the Trump administration has been ravenously confirming judges to lower courts. Just recently, another 15 judges were confirmed to federal courts, all of them obedient new right conservatives, some of them approved by the Federal Society, which has formed the backbone of Trump's judicial reformation. This is a state organ which has been fundamentally reshaped to uphold corporate power, weaken civil rights, and most importantly, defend the administration at any cost. As a government without popular approval, the Trump regime literally cannot allow for the free exercise of democratic power without jeopardizing its own security. Anything less than a stranglehold on state machinery would result in a disastrous electoral loss for the GOP. To justify their authoritarian methods, the regime is stoking fears of left-wing violence and social chaos. Our next interview is with the spokesperson from Rose City Antifa, who discusses the events in Portland over the past few weeks. The conversation covers a lot of ground, starting with how the right media took a protest vigil organized for Patrick Kimmons, an African-American man killed by the police, and turned it into a tale of, quote, Antifa taking over the city to attack supposed white motorists. We then discuss the events that happened last weekend, where on Saturday night, Joey Gibson and members of the Proud Boys, Patriot Prayer, and other far-right and white nationalist groups held a flash, quote, law and order rally, ostensibly in response to the buzz that was generated in far-right media over the past week. This messaging, however, soon changed with news of the Proud Boys attack in New York taking over the airwaves, and the rally was then changed to being against Mayor Ted Wheeler. Gibson's goons then proceeded to harass a vigil for Kimmons, where Patriot Prayer members chanted, quote, Crip lives don't matter, and then proceeded to march around the city looking for victims to beat up, settling on a small group of about five or so anti-fascist protesters who had been separated from a larger group and were located outside of a bar. Ironically, in the wake of the latest violence, Joey Gibson has attempted to argue that the people who carried out the assaults on his side were, quote, not with him. After the violence of this weekend, however, Portland police announced that back during the massive anti-fascist mobilization against Patriot Prayer on August 4th in the city of Portland, they had in fact found a stash of weapons and people associated with Patriot Prayer on top of a roof, overlooking the counter-protesters. Police claimed that they were armed with long guns as well as concealed weapons, which they had permits for, and were quickly then let loose after leaving the rooftop. The latest news has caused an outrage as Portland police nearly killed one anti-fascist counter-protester with a flashbang grenade and lied about bottles being thrown at them to justify attacking the huge anti-fascist mobilization of several thousand. Police then allowed members of Patriot Prayer on August 4th to essentially roam the city, attacking random people at will. After releasing news of the weapons being found on top of the roof, the Portland mayor, Ted Wheeler, then announced that he was pushing a new protest ordinance that would in the future put opposing sides of demonstrations into protest pens. Rose City Antifa and a host of other groups have attacked this proposal as an assault on basic fundamental rights and also as a rubber stamp of police containment and attack on anti-fascist protesters that the state has already been employing now for years. This new ordinance, they argue, will essentially facilitate and protect the violent fascist groups whenever and wherever they choose to rally. We've got a lot to cover, but first, let's get to the news. Courts have ruled the construction for the Keystone XL pipeline will now begin in 2019, and if completed, will move billions of gallons of crude oil out of the tar sands and into the U.S. Native and ecological groups have already been making plans to resist the project. In Eugene, Oregon, a local business owner known for making swastika cookies and for posting in white nationalist forums is upset that local anti-fascists have called her a neo-Nazi and has responded by suing them after hiring a longtime neo-Nazi organizer, William Johnson. Johnson, along with racist skinheads, years ago helped form the American Third Position Party. In Florida, a chapter of Turning Point USA, a quote conservative group backed by billionaires and the president, has been found to be strongly influenced by the alt-right and its memes, as the Daily Beast wrote, quote, one member of the group posted a meme featuring a brown Pepe the Frog, the alt-right's mascot, sexually assaulting a Swedish woman, while another brown Pepe holds a gun to a man's head. In the background of the image, a refugees welcome sign implies that Muslim refugees in Europe will rape women. Posters in the forum also urge people to tone down their anti-Semitism lest they be seen, and urge them to be careful not to mention too many times alt-right figurehead Richard Spencer. Trump has once again stated that he will send thousands of soldiers to the U.S. border as a caravan of people has now left Honduras and is marching to Mexico. They are asking to be allowed sanctuary in the United States. Far-right Republicans have responded by also playing at fears and conspiracy theories, some stating that marchers are being paid by George Soros. As one report stated, quote, the Mexican government has responded to Trump's orders by preparing to carry out the dirty work for his administration's crackdown on immigrants, including physical repression. Yesterday, black airplanes carrying around several hundred Mexican federal police officers armed with riot gear arrived at the Mexico-Guatemala border. Helicopters were also deployed to monitor the border region. CNN Today reported, a chaotic scene unfolded as a massive caravan of Honduran migrants reached the Guatemala-Mexico border Friday. Surge of migrants broke through a steel fence that had been padlocked shut. Mexican police in riot gear pushed them back, setting off smoke canisters. Hundreds of Mexican federal police sealed the border as drones and helicopters hovered over the crowd, which waited on a bridge in sweltering heat. Thousands of migrants were waiting to cross, according to CNN teams at the scene. At least a dozen migrants stuck on the bridge have jumped into the river below. It is unclear if they are trying to swim across the Mexican side of the border, go back to Guatemala, or just get relief from the crowds on the bridge. The migrants who remain told CNN they joined the caravan because they had no other choice, noting that they were desperate for work. Mexican officials have said people seeking asylum would be processed at the border, but it is unclear what will happen next. Members of the group, many with children in tow, have cheered and chanted as they stream towards the port of entry, with celebratory air horns blaring. On October 16th, students protest against Goldman Sachs recruiting at an event at Brown University and their backing of Energy Transfer Partners, which is pushing to build the tail end of the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Bayou Bridge. Meanwhile, in Haiti, protests continued against government corruption. And on August 17th, the court dismissed an eviction attempt against a rent strike organizer in Portland, Oregon. Meanwhile, in the Florida Panhandle, Mutual Aid Disaster Relief reports directly from the impacted disaster site, quote, Florida Panhandle hurricane survivors need support and solidarity. Displacement and trauma, along with existing in a community made unrecognizable, looking like a bomb dropped, are the realities. Many pathways for autonomous relief and response alongside community-led efforts exist. The Unitarian Universalist Church of Panama City has been generous enough to let us use their building as a community hub for relief efforts. If you would like to assist the relief and recovery efforts here, email mutualaiddisasterrelief@gmail.com. People with chainsaw experience, construction experience, and people able to do mobile distribution from their vehicles are especially needed at this time. You can check them out on Facebook for more information. On October 18th, Lois Leviacamp organized a disruption of an Energy Transfer Partners meeting to demand the end of the construction of the BioBridge pipeline and to stop repression of water protectors. Two people were arrested. In Chicago, the Autonomous Tenants Union organized a disruption and picket of homes being shown by landlords that were recently had their tenants evicted from. In so-called Victoria, Canada, tiny house warriors erected another tiny home, this one located on the University of Victoria campus. On October 19th, Parkdale organized won a victory against attempted eviction of several rent strike organizers. And again, the Lois Leviacamp organized a lockdown action against Kelsey Warren, the CEO of Energy Transfer Partners, at their home. That's going to do it for us until next week. We will see you soon. Also, help us keep the lights on and it's going down. We have launched a crowdfunding campaign going till the end of the year. If you can, please, anything helps. $1, $5, $20. If you have more to donate, please do. If you want to organize a benefit event for us, please do. We're going to see this project through many years. We need your help to continue on, and we look forward to everything that lays in the future ahead of us. See our show notes for how to donate, and let's get to the interviews. We hope that you are enjoying this episode of This is America, or the latest episode of the It's Going Down podcast. We know that a growing number of the proletarian community tune in every week to hear both resistance news and the latest headlines on everything from climate change to Trump.
Yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell!
But before you fast forward that dial...
Hell no, it can't wait! Your lives will be affected!
We bring you a special announcement. We need your help this winter in meeting our fundraising goal of $10,000. So if you don't want to see IGD slowing down anytime soon,
say hell no, motherfuckers!
Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Give us a one-time donation, buy some awesome swag, or sign up to become a monthly supporter.
Now, I want you to go in that bag and find my wallet.
Which one is it?
It's the one that says bad mother...
And now... back to the show.
Okay, today we're talking to Greg Palast. He's the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. You know him through his investigative reports that have been on the BBC, The Guardian, Democracy Now!, and Rolling Stone. He has a film that you can check out through Amazon Prime, and also check out his website, gregpalast.com. Greg, I was hoping you could take us back to the lead up to the Trump election, and you were covering a story about a program called CrossCheck, and I remember hearing about it on the radio, you know, through Democracy Now! And other programs, and there was hardly any coverage of it. I was curious if you could tell us, what is CrossCheck?
CrossCheck is the way that Donald Trump won the election, not by winning votes. Trump didn't win. In fact, the updated version of my film, which came out actually this week, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, is now called The Case of the Stolen Election. Before the election, I released the film. It was a warning. There's a system, CrossCheck, which was created by Trump's, the guy that's running the GOP purge programs, where they remove voters from the voter rolls, especially black voters, by the millions, by the way. And I investigated this for first Al Jazeera, then Rolling Stone. I've been on it for 5 years and covering this guy, Chris Kobach of Kansas. Here's what it is. You know, Trump said that 3 million people voted twice illegally, and the mainstream press made fun of it. I wasn't laughing because I actually obtained – I'm an investigative reporter. If you know Greg Palast, I wear that fedora. So, you know, I'm an investigative reporter. And I obtained the lists. And altogether, there are 3 million people that they have accused of voting twice in two different states in the same election. In other words, they have – and this is a real example. They have a Maria Hernandez. She voted in Virginia, and they say they found a Maria Hernandez on the voter rolls of Louisiana. So Maria Hernandez, they say, voted twice. Now, you might say, well, Maria Hernandez is a common name. There could be two. But it's not a common name for a Republican. And in fact, this is, and again, it's a real example, Maria in one state, it's Maria Inez Hernandez. In another state, it's Maria Cristina Hernandez. So this voter, supposed to be the same voter, voting twice illegally, is in fact, they have different middle names. So, you know, it's clear that these are two different people. Why does it matter if they make what is an absurd accusation? The answer is that they're removing those people from the voter rolls. They're accusing them. Now, here's the interesting little twist. The public game is that they're accusing Maria Hernandez of voting twice in the same election in two different states. But in fact, what they're doing, and this is what's devious, they're saying the list is simply a list of people who've moved. They've claimed that Maria Hernandez moved from Kentucky, from Virginia to Louisiana. And that, by the way, and they also said that she moved from Louisiana to Virginia. It's the same voter moving out of state from one state to the other. And they say, well, because Maria Hernandez has moved out of state, we can remove her from the voter rolls. Now you say, well, that's insane. No, it's brilliant, because you get rid of a lot of people named Maria Hernandez and James Brown and David Lee and David Kim. This is how they get rid of these voters. Now, understand that how they know it's minority voters? Well, obviously, in a lot of states like Georgia, they actually put your race next to your name. But most important is that the algorithm that is deciding who's voted twice or who has moved from one state to the other, you know, where are these voters in two states, they simply use the first and last name. And I mean, that's it. First and last name is all they use. So you have James Brown, Maria Hernandez, and here's the trick. 85 of the 100 most common last names in America, according to the census, 85 of the most common 100 names in America are minority names. Black, Johnson, Kim, Lee, Rodriguez, Garcia. You get the idea.
Well, I think a lot of people listening to this might say, hold on, how can that possibly be legal? Like, this is starting to sound like a conspiracy, because there's got to be a system in place to stop somebody from doing this. Because, I mean, anybody can put their name into Google and find, you know, 20 other people that have your exact same name.
Well, not a Koch, Kobach, Trump. These names are quite unique, whereas Garcia is not. That's their protection. And who is going to question this? Number one, it needs the press. And the fourth is, remember, I write, the original story was broken for Al Jazeera, right, which is just considered terrorist TV. The other, then I did, and I was an investigative reporter. If you know me, and this is Greg Palast, I was an investigative reporter for The Guardian newspapers and for BBC television in London.
Right.
If it wasn't for British reporting, we'd have no information on our bent elections. I'm the reporter who, back in 2000, for example, discovered that Catherine Harris had removed tens of thousands of people from the Georgia voter rolls as felons who were not allowed to vote. In fact, they were black men whose only crime was voting while black. And that only came out because I put it in The Guardian, I put it at the top of the BBC Nightly News, and The Times did cover it. 2 years later, 2 years later, that's what the Times, that was the great New York Times. You have these organizations that are these, you know, pseudo news organizations in the U.S. that do not cover issues that they consider race issues. This is the big problem we're facing.
I mean, so there was literally no one, I mean, in the U.S. outside of, you know, what you're calling underground press that was literally covering this. Nobody wanted to touch this? I mean,
well, like I say, no one. When I did the story on the removal of the black voters from the Georgia voter rolls, ultimately the U.S. Civil Rights Commission said I was exactly right. The New York Times talked about the infamous Florida voter purge of 2000, mm-hmm. which how could it be infamous? They didn't even report on it at the time. They waited 2 years. You and basically, so you have a U.S. press which is completely dead on the issue of, you know, there's an assumption that America has wonderful elections that no one can mess with. And if anyone's messing with it, it's got to be the Russians, because Americans would never do this. You know, Republicans would never remove black people from the voter rolls. So, you know, and you listen to Hillary Clinton. I mean, she said, you know, how dare Donald Trump talk about a rigged election? Well, wait, she should have said, yeah, the election's rigged. Your cronies are rigging it.
Right. Well, let's turn real quick to Kris Kobach. I'm pronouncing it right. Kris Kobach?
Yes, that's correct. So,
and we've, on It's Going Down, we've written pretty extensively about a group called the Federation for American Immigration Reform. We think this group is really important. They have various legal arms like the Center for Immigration Studies and various other think tanks. They come out of, you know, essentially white nationalism and eugenics. They have a variety of people within the Trump administration that have worked for them for a fair amount of time. Everyone from Kellyanne Conway to especially people like Steve Miller, people that are really essentially writing a lot of the immigration policy in the U.S. that when we think about the Trump administration are really tied to FAIR. And Kris Kobach is a huge part of that. I'm just curious.
Legal counsel.
Right. So after Trump wins, can you just talk a little bit about basically how he tried to take this cross-check thing and really spread it?
Well, I think he's done so successfully, but he's a brilliant strategist. By the way, Kobach graduated from Harvard, Yale, and Oxford. And don't assume that he doesn't know what he's talking about or his strategies are not dangerous. Kobach was and actually still lists himself as counsel while he's Secretary of State and running for governor of Kansas. He lists himself as counsel for FAIR, the legal counsel for FAIR. Which says, its founder said, the purpose of FAIR is to maintain a European majority in America. And I guess there's not a lot of brown or black-skinned Europeans that I think that he's referring to. So it is Kris Kobach, and I rarely use this phrase, is a white supremacist. And he is basically in charge of the Republican strategy to bend elections by removing voters of color. That's the trick. Trump, for example, after the election, appointed Kobach as head of what was, you know, generally called the Voter Fraud Commission. Now, liberals are happy that it collapsed because reporters like me filed Freedom of Information requests on the commission, and suddenly he realized that he had to release all the internal documents. So Kobach folded the commission. The problem is, and here's a warning, the commission officially folded, but its work was then taken over by the Department of Homeland Security so that whatever they do can be hidden under the cloak of national security. So if you try to put in a Freedom of Information Act request, they say, well, this is a national security matter, as if removing Maria Hernandez from the voter rolls wrongly is somehow a national security matter. So Kobach is very important. He's the guy, by the way, and you'll see this in my film. He's the guy who came up with the Muslim ban. He's the guy who actually came up with the idea of Mexico paying for the wall. He wrote Arizona's law SB 1070 while he's working as Secretary of State of Kansas. SB 1070 was what the ACLU called the driving while Brown law. It's profiling. And he's written laws for Kansas and Alabama and Georgia and a few other states, which so far have been blocked by the lower courts, but which would require you to prove you're a citizen in order to register to vote, which may sound okay on the surface, except we don't have citizenship cards and citizenship badges in the United States yet. The only proof of citizenship is a passport, which is pretty much a white travel document. And secondarily, your original birth certificate, which when he tried this law in Kansas, basically knocked out students who don't know where their parents put their birth certificates. So, you know, this is the guy who's really running this racist purge programs, including the ones that I am investigating and filing lawsuits over in Georgia right now.
Well, let's turn towards towards those states now. So now we're leading up to the midterms. There's been some discussion in some states about Republicans kicking largely African Americans off the voting rolls. Can you just tell us about how this is all playing out?
Well, in Georgia, for example, where Brian Kemp, an acolyte of Chris Kobach, he's Secretary of State of Georgia, which means he's in charge of determining who gets the vote, who's on the voter rolls, who is kicked off the voter rolls, where you have the votes, which votes are counted. Because remember, in America, we now have what's called provisional ballots, and they have to be approved to be counted. Most are thrown in the garbage, and absentee ballots. I would note that Chris Kobach absolutely, unquestionably stole the Republican nomination for governor in Kansas this year because he was in charge of the vote count. And supposedly he won over the sitting Republican governor by 300 votes, not counting several thousand votes that were cast in his opponent's favor. Kemp is trying to repeat that in Georgia. He has I was able to obtain the Georgia cross-check list, and I told you about those cross-check lists. It's the Georgia cross-check list on which we based our analysis for Rolling Stone and Al Jazeera, that the lists were unbelievably racially biased, and by the way, ridiculously wrong. One-fourth of the names, one-fourth of these matches are have mismatched middle names, and you have, like, for example, James Brown Sr. and James Brown Jr. are supposed to be the same voters. That's one of the tricks used by Brian Kemp against his opponent, Stacey Abrams, who, she wins, will become the first African-American female governor in American history.
So you're saying that even if the middle name is different, that they'll still kick you off the rolls through that program?
Yeah, here's how they do it. They don't kick off everyone. Everyone, like, for example, Georgia has 500,000 names on the purge list, but they've removed about 108,000. And what they do is they say, well, what's the big deal that the middle names mismatch? We send them a postcard. All you have to do is send back the postcard, and you've saved your vote. You confirm your mailing address. Well, I can tell you, these cards, I have the Kemp postcard designed by Kobach, you know, it's just junk mail, and you throw it away. And in, for example, in Ohio, the state of Ohio, which also uses this trick, again, where a Republican Secretary of State is running for governor, they admit that 80% of people simply throw them away. In Illinois, Illinois just gave me their records. 95% of people who get mailed these cards throw them away. And they say if they mail you a card and you don't return it, that means that you've moved out of the state. I kid you not. They say that's evidence you moved out of the state. And we have experts who are saying what any normal person, you don't need a PhD to figure out, but sending someone a postcard and they don't return it doesn't mean that they've moved to another state.
So if somebody is kicked off through that method and then they still in their head, I mean, they're not aware because they got some stupid little postcard and they're kicked off the rolls, could they still go through the process of voting and then their vote wouldn't count? Or how would that play out if they tried to vote either by going to a station or trying to do it through the mail?
Well, number one, if they they're put on what's called an inactive list. So that, here's the other thing. You have to miss two more. Generally, not in Indiana, they just wiped you off if you're on the cross-check list. And I just posted, by the way, gregpalace.com, the names of people who were removed by cross-check in Indiana, 28,000 people. It looks maybe up to 20,000 were removed in violation of a federal court order not to do this, by the way. And if you go to gregpalace.com, you can see if your name's on there. And this is an interesting thing. So, for example, in the case of Indiana, where they had a court order, if you go to gregpalace.com and you're in Indiana, find your name on the purge list, you put in your first, last name and zip code. They're telling me if you bring your ID that shows your voting address on it, you know, as if you have a driver's license that has your registration address, but God forbid you've moved down the street, they say that they'll count your vote. I don't you know, good. I think you should try. In Georgia, if you're on the list and you show up to vote, they'll hand you a provisional ballot, because anyone who's not on the voter rolls gets a provisional ballot if you ask for it. Now, I call it a placebo ballot, because provisional ballots, in about half the cases, they will not count that vote. They're going to throw it in the garbage. Why? Because if you are purged from the voter rolls, even if you're purged wrongly, even if you've been, even if your registration has been canceled wrongly, your vote will not count, because if you're not on the rolls, you're not on the rolls. All they're doing is checking as if you're on a central database. So for the most part, that's why I believe people should check their registrations right now. By the way, if you're listening to this in Nevada, in Vegas or Reno, go to gregpalace.com. You still have a couple days to register to vote, and put in your first name, last name, where you see the Nevada flag, and we'll tell you if you've been purged, and your zip code. By the way, we don't, unlike Kobach, we actually send your entire address back to you so you can confirm, oh, that's me. We don't just say Maria Hernandez. Oh, you've been purged. No, we don't do the Kobach. Same with Illinois. There's still a few days left to register. If you're in Chicago or in Illinois, go to gregpalace.com. Type in your name. If you're purged, re-register right now. Now you can. We also have the purge list for Georgia. Because you have to understand, we sued a lot of these secretaries of state,
right.
In fact, all of them on the cross-check program. When I say sued, I should clarify that. We've sent notices that we will take you into federal court in 90 days if you don't give us the names of the people you've purged and other information and the backup. But most of these GOP secretaries of state waited till the 89th day to send us this data. And so, unfortunately, in some states, you know, we just didn't get it in time before the re-registration deadline, or just a couple days and before the deadline. In Georgia, we had 48 days, 100,000 people checked our site, thousands of people seeking the information, but we only had 48 hours.
I'm curious, can you talk a little bit more about, you mentioned that there was a connection between Kobach and the governor of Georgia. Can you, I mean, are these people just trading like, hey, this is how you do it, man? Like,
well, no, it's very formal. The way the cross-check list works is that Brian Kemp of Georgia and John Husted, the ultra-right purging general of Ohio, purging the voter rolls of Ohio, and Kobach, all these other GOP secretaries of state, like from Nevada and other states, they send their entire voter rolls to Chris Kobach in Kansas, though many of them deny they've done it. Kobach is very proud. Kobach has showed me the list. I have the information from Kobach's office that they're doing this. Kobach takes all the names from every state and then creates these pairs of voters. So in other words, he'll take, for example, Georgia has 327 voters named James Brown who were on the cross-check list because each one, believe it or not, there's a James Brown in Atlanta and one in Motown in Detroit and one in Arizona and one in right. Missouri. And they've paired them kind of randomly as far as I could see. They've paired them and said, aha, this is information that these voters have moved. They send those lists back to each of the members of the cross-check system. So the Georgia cross-check file came from Kobach. All these files come from Chris Kobach, who has mushed together all these voter files, pairing first and last names and sending them back and saying, okay, you can send these people a postcard. And that begins the process of removing them from the voter rolls. There's a very, very direct connection, because literally they're giving these states give the Kobach the list, they get them back, and that's how they begin acting on them. I want to mention that Brian Kemp of Georgia, running against Stacey Abrams, has suddenly said, we don't use the cross-check list. We've never used the cross-check list, not according to Kobach and not according to Kemp himself. I've been reporting on Kemp and cross-check and Kobach for 5 years, And never in 5 years, while Kemp has defended himself against my exposés in Rolling Stone and elsewhere, he's never once said, oh, we don't just don't use it. This is brand new. So one of the things I'm going to have to do is haul his behind into federal court and let him say that under oath. You'd be surprised how people change their stories when they're facing perjury charges for lying.
Right. Well, listen, this has been a fabulous conversation. I mean, really mind-blowing just the amount of influence that Kobach has. And we encourage people, again, to read up on Kobach and his connection to FAIR. One last question. I know you're a busy guy right now and you've got other interviews today. But I think a lot of people at this point have got to be asking themselves, you know, you brought up, you know, bringing this guy to court. I mean, there's got to be a lawsuit in the works. I mean, how are people legally, there's got to be a bunch of people up in arms about this because it's so clear what they're doing. I mean, not only is this, you know, structural white supremacy and work beyond Kobach, but also, I mean, to me, this really signals like, you know, the elites trying to not only push people of color, but also, you know, kind of get to a point where it's like, you know, rich people with property are the ones that basically have a say in society.
Yes.
And, you know, what legally, how are people fighting back, if at all?
Well, I'm going to tell you, we have announced that we're preparing a lawsuit against Brian Kemp, and we may be suing several other states. Other groups have come to us. But I have to say that the backup, my co-plaintiff in Georgia is the coalition for Georgia Coalition for a People's Agenda. That's the great civil rights leader, Reverend Joseph Lowry. In Illinois, my co-plaintiff is the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We have basically the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The NAACP of Atlanta has jumped in with us. Basically, in other words, what you're getting is, a bunch of African-American activists, Hispanic activists. What we don't have, and we have a lot of backing from the Congressional Black Caucus, what we are missing is the Congressional White Caucus. We, other than some help from ACLU and bless them, and some of the activist lawyers that come out of the ACLU, we have basically had no help from white activists or the white side of the Democratic Party concerned about what happens to black voters. In fact, sometimes active resistance we're getting, like and hostility from the white press. When you say I have a lot of media, I have a lot of African American media. I'm about to go on Al Sharpton's program, and I was just on Jesse Jackson's Sunday morning program, and I'm all over. So I'm just, it's pretty hard to get pale face coverage of the loss of the black and Hispanic, and I would add Asian American vote. And that's their new aim, because you can imagine if your name is David Kim, the chance that you're on a cross check list is near certain in the two dozen cross check states.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. It's very illuminating. Encourage people to check out your website and your work. If you want to plug anything else, feel free.
Well, two things. One, absolutely go to gregpalast.com, GREGPALAST, gregpalast.com, to see if you've been purged, to keep informed, you know, sign up to keep informed of the of all the information we are putting out daily and the purge lists we're putting out daily. Spread the word. If you know people in Georgia, Nevada, Illinois, Indiana, we're putting out Arizona. We're going to be putting up a lot more lists to go there. But even more important, find out, get the story, go watch the film. It's free on Amazon Prime. The best democracy money can buy. I guarantee you, it's not your typical PBS white guys in front of bookcases documentary. It is entertaining. And it's also heartbreaking. We do have, you know, Rosario Dawson and Willie Nelson and Ice-T in the film. It's a documentary, but, you know, we're trying to make it so that, you know, you'll laugh at the craziness and cry when you see America stab itself in its ideological heart. It's pretty, it's pretty rough stuff. But so get the best democracy money can buy, The Case of the Stolen Election. which you can download the brand new version today.
Hey, thanks so much. Take care.
I will. You're the best.
Yeah.
I've been on the lift of fist, spit the resistance shit since 96 or since time and a bit, grip the mic, spit the rhyme that split the mind into bit size and design lines to politicize my gift into paradigm shifting. Gone distances, long distances, armed with mic like bombs and bricks, and I wrap this with the blacklisted, the black banner lifter, anarchistas. My jams have been banned from Christmas, man. Too damn anti-capitalist. Smash system, crash the market. Smack the shit out of they fascist talk with bars that crack the whack the saw. The mob at the wall getting larger, larger, large,
large. I want you to get mad. You got to get mad.
I talk shit with my fist in the ball of it, at all of it. Cops, bosses, and economists, and the columnists, electoral politics, charity, violent doctor, lawyer, court order, news reporter. I march my shit to Mordor, record and perform to kick down doors with it. Ramp the anti-authority, black corridor, road, rail, and port.
Okay, we're joined here today with David, spokesperson for Rose City Antifa out of Portland, Oregon. We're going to be covering a lot of ground today. We're going to be talking about kind of how a lot of this wave of media frenzy around Antifa has kind of flared up again, largely centered in Portland, discussion of the Proud Boys, and also now new information has come out from the local police about a weapon stash that was found on August 4th, and that's now leading the city to propose a new protest ordinance, which really infringes on people's civil liberties and right to protest. But let's just get started. David, take us back to this recent incident. There was a march and a vigil to remember a 27-year-old gentleman, Patrick Kimmons, I believe, who was killed by the Portland Police Department. There was a march, and there was a car that drove into the demonstration, and this somehow became frontline news that Antifa had somehow taken over the city, was directing traffic, and my favorite, that they were somehow targeting white drivers for beatings. Can you just tell us what in reality actually happened?
Yeah, I can try. I actually wasn't down there. Our group wasn't down there for that particular rally. That's kind of a different group of protesters who was doing that rally, not any anti-fascist groups. But what seems to have happened is that they were doing a vigil and doing a demonstration in the intersection, and a driver tried to push through the demonstration. And they seemed very irate and angry and were yelling at the demonstrators and so on and so forth. And they moved at a fairly slow speed and then pushed some protesters out of the way with their bumper, and the protesters responded by yelling back and hitting the car a little bit. That's what seems to happen. But this incident got completely blown out of proportion by the right media and by a lot of the local far right personalities who are looking for these kinds of excuses to allege some sort of like attack on ordinary people by protesters in downtown areas. And they treated this like the person was dragged from their car and so on and so forth, when none of that actually happened. They also misrepresented like who the protesters were and what the cause was and all of this, these various things.
Right. So this was a demonstration that was organized by the person who was killed, his family, correct?
Yeah, and some other local support groups that have been active in a lot of the don't shoot and sort of anti-police brutality campaigns around town.
Yeah, I mean, this tendency to equate everything with Antifa is, I don't know, do you want to speak to that? I mean, what do you think is the logic behind this?
It reminds me a lot of about a decade ago how these sort of boogeyman for the far right was Black Bloc. You know, everything was Black Bloc. Black Bloc was doing this, Black Bloc was doing that. And now it's just Antifa. So they've got a new buzzword that is probably stemming from the times that we have here, when we have all this resurgence of fascist groups. We obviously have a lot more anti-fascists out there in the streets opposing these fascist groups. So the far right is using that as an opportunity to create this demon that they can ascribe anything bad that happens in the city to this group.
I think it also is really telling because, I mean, if you watch like InfoWars, if you listen to Tucker Carlson, I mean, they really hammer home this point of like, you know, they're looking for white people. They're going to kill Trump supporters. Like, they're really trying to whip up fear within a certain segment of the population. And, you know, I mean, all they have to do, again, is, I mean, and I think that when people already have that intrinsic fear, especially if they look at something like Black Lives Matter and they are fearful of it for some reason, even if it's misguided, I mean, then they have somebody in power that's in the media that can really speak to that fear and say some off the wall thing that isn't necessarily true.
Yeah, I think this is pretty typical behavior for far right groups and these white nationalist, white supremacist groups, as they find some sort of a group that they can use as a target, and they can present this group as a threat, and then this group can become the focal point for their own violence, and that can kind of stoke up their own groups, make them feel tough and gain them political power on the streets by going out and intimidating people and attacking people. And, you know, we see this happening in all kinds of different venues across the country right now. We see this happening on college campuses where liberals and other, you know, the sort of cliche of social justice warriors, people who just, you know, want to discuss like gender and women's studies issues in class, are now presented as some sort of existential threat. There's this idea that the streets are filled with communists, and if they don't get out there with guns and start gunning down these communists, then, you know, Stalin is going to rise from the dead or something like that. Who knows exactly what their theories are, but they need somebody that they can demonize in order to go out there and sort of enact this violence, as we, you know, have been seeing on in the streets the last week.
Well, one last question in regards specifically to this incident, but I mean, there's a lot of talk, like the way this was framed was like, you know, Antifa taking over the streets, you know, they're directing traffic, you know, it almost seemed like this quasi, you know, this one, you know, rather tame in many ways, besides this person trying to run into people with their car, but this kind of, you know, average, tame, you know, not to delineate or dilute what people did that day. It was great that they went out there for the person that was killed by the police, but, you know, this kind of average protest, and they assigned it these like revolutionary, like, you know, aspects to it. But I think a lot of that has to do with their narrative that they want to put out there, that like the mayor is not in control, or the mayor is basically giving the keys to the city to, you know, Antifa or Black Lives Matter or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it really was like a very small protest on the whole, as Portland protests go. And considering the number of streets that are currently blocked due to the construction of new housing developments, you know, the idea that this was somehow impeding the flow of downtown traffic in any serious way is very overblown.
Right. Well, let's move on now to the next segment. So a couple days after this kind of hits the media, there's something that happens in New York on Friday night. Gavin McInnes speaks. He's the leader of the Proud Boys. He's written for white nationalist publications for years, connected to people like Richard Spencer, who got him a job at Talkies magazine. He founded the Proud Boys, which is like an ultra-nationalist, pro-Trump, essentially a gang in 2016. People in the Proud Boys were very much involved in Unite the Right. So he speaks at a Republican club on Friday night. There was a brawl. And then the next night, Patriot Prayer calls for a demonstration in Portland, ostensibly under the guise of all this stuff that's been building in the right-wing media to, like, how would you describe it, to take the streets back from the traffic directing anti-fascists?
Yeah, I mean, they called it like a law and order protest is what they, you know, ridiculously named their thing. And they presented it as if it was a last minute kind of event because they only made it public like the day before. But in actuality, they had been planning this some time in advance. I'm not exactly sure how far in advance they were planning it, but definitely further than, you know, at least a week in advance. And they kind of used this incident with the Patrick Kimmins vigil as a reason to go out there and do their thing, but then you know, once they get out there, of course Joey Gibson is famous for constantly changing his statements about why he's doing what he's doing and what his group is and what they mean. He said after they got out there, he said it's not about that at all. It's about the mayor, and he sort of changed the whole rationale for them being there, which is pretty typical for him, and that's one reason that we really don't listen to what he says. On the contrary, we look at what he does, and what he did was he gathered a group of about 100 armed and armored street fighters, like both Proud Boys and other people from the Patriot Prayer Group, other unaffiliated people that we've seen at these various far-right rallies around Portland, and they marched around Portland looking for targets. And there was a group of people out there of anti-fascists and other allied people who were down there to kind of keep an eye out and make sure that they didn't attack the vigil. And then once the majority of that group had decided to back off in order to not cause a confrontation with the Patriot Prayer Group, the Patriot Prayer Group was able to find a group of about 5 or 6 individuals that were left behind. They were stragglers. And then when they found these stragglers, they immediately attacked them.
I just want to be really clear on one thing, is that there was a vigil for Patrick Kimmins, the man that was killed by Portland police a couple weeks ago, organized by his family, and Patriot Prayer essentially chose to rally next to, or at least start off the rally next to where the vigil was happening. And when they, you know, basically came up against it, they were chanting things like USA while the other side was chanting Black Lives Matter. So, I mean, it was very clear that they were antagonistic towards, you know, this man's family who is mourning and grieving the passing of their father, you know, their brother, their sibling, you know, community member.
Yeah, definitely. Their march, they organized their march so that it would go directly past the vigil so that they could have that sort of taunt. And that they could hopefully find some sort of confrontation, which, of course, is the real reason that they're out there.
And, I mean, has that been really hit upon in the local media? I feel like that aspect is almost just kind of brushed aside. I mean, the fact that they, you know, went to this, you know, community mourning thing, which obviously was – you know, the vigil itself was not designed to, you know, confront anybody. It was designed to create a space for people to mourn.
Yeah, I mean, I think the media definitely focuses on the violence and tries to diagnose exactly where that starts, but they don't go back to look at the original reason that they were all out there and the reason that they came down there and what they were looking to accomplish by marching past that vigil.
So you were saying that basically Patriot Prayer at that point, you know, they left and they looked for targets. You said that they, you know, attacked about 4 or 5 people that were stragglers. And then I believe, based on our reading of social media, they tried to go to some bars where they thought that people might be.
Yeah, there were a lot of rumors going around, so it was kind of unclear what their actual plan had been, but they were definitely like on the prowl, as it were, looking for more opportunities, trying to goad out more people that they could then, you know, catch people in smaller groups and attack them.
You mentioned that you know, it's a good idea not to really play too much into what Joey Gibson says, because just so much of what comes out of his mouth is just total lies, and he changes back and forth so many times. But I mean, after the night was over, I mean, there were brutal clashes that took place. What did Gibson say about it?
From what I saw in the media, it looked like he was trying to disavow any connection with that. He said that the people we're fighting were just like some random people that happened to be walking along with his group, as if he had no idea that they would show up, and you know, there was no connection between all of the armed people that gathered for his rally and the violence that those people then committed.
Right. Wow. Well, let's move on now. So the next day brought a bombshell. The police came out saying that on August 4th, which was huge mass mobilization, Patriot Prayer brought in a couple hundred people. A lot of groups from Unite the Right were there. People were extremely heavily armed, lots of militia people. The police basically refused to put them into a protest area and check their weapons. And essentially formed a line around their rally against the anti-fascists. And when Patriot Prayer was ready to march, the police unloaded a barrage of projectile weapons. One person was almost killed. They were shot in the back of the head while they were running, and luckily they had a helmet on, but they tear gas canister struck the back of their head, and they, you know, were sent to the hospital. They almost died. If they wouldn't have had the helmet on, they probably would have been killed. Caused a huge outrage of controversy, but it was just released yesterday by the police, probably because of everything that's been happening nationally with the Proud Boys, that in fact on that day the police found people on a rooftop with some weapons. But can you just tell us exactly what all did the police say went down yesterday?
Yeah, let me walk it back a little bit and try and contextualize, because I think this will become important for trying to understand what the police's motivations and how that works into the what Patriot Prayer does in conjunction with the police. So they originally said, the police said on August 4th, that they were going to allow people to come down to the waterfront and enter the zone that they had closed off. And anybody would be allowed in there as long as they were searched and weren't carrying any weapons. They had decided that this would be like a weapons-free space. So that was what they had announced ahead of time. But when it actually came down to the matter, what they did was they let the far-right protesters, all these white nationalist groups, enter this waterfront area, and they did not search any of them. They said that they seized some weapons, but the vast majority of them were let in without being searched. They were allowed to keep whatever weapons they had on them. And then that space, surrounded by fences and surrounded by police, was considered to be the space for the far right, for the white nationalists. Then when the anti-fascist counter-protests, which marched from an area around City Hall, was approaching the waterfront area, which is a huge area, to be sure. There would have been plenty of room for both groups to be in the waterfront area, in the waterfront park, without being anywhere near each other. The park is over a mile long. The police blocked the anti-fascist march access to the waterfront area. They blocked off the street and kept them penned in the street across this kind of major road that separates the downtown area from the waterfront area. That maintained for a while. The police made a lot of motions about trying to get people out of the streets onto the sidewalks, but with over 1,000 people in attendance there in the countermarch, there was really no way to effectively do that. Then the countermarch started to move around a little bit, trying to find a way to get to the waterfront, circling around through the streets of downtown, until they ended up penned in yet again by the police in this area on Southwest Columbia Avenue. And it was at this point, with the anti-fascist march having nowhere to go, no way to get out, the police opened fire with the explosives and chemical weapons and so on and so forth. And that's where the events you described took place, where the people were severely injured and maimed by the grenades being shot, and the one person was hit in the head. So what we found out this week was something, you know, and the police at the time, back on August 4th, they had said that this was justified by the fact that somebody from the anti-fascist side had thrown something at the police officers, but the media were never able to find any video of that happening. There was no confirmation of that. On the contrary, they appeared to fire without warning. And the police at that time made a huge stink about the threat that the anti-fascists posed, how that they were the ones there for violence, even though, you know, it was the white nationalist side that was allowed to keep their weapons and have free run of the waterfront park. And additionally, after the police fired upon the anti-fascist side, then the white nationalists were able to cross the street and enter the downtown area and start attacking people, with the police doing nothing to stop it. So the police made this whole big stink about how you know, the anti-fascist side was the one that was violent and that they deserved what they got, and so on and so forth. So cut to this week, what we learn is that at that time, the police had discovered a group, one of these white nationalist groups, on a rooftop overlooking the area where the anti-fascists were penned in by the police. And these white nationalists had assault rifles up on this rooftop. And the police allowed them to keep those rifles and did nothing about it, first of all, while additionally continuing to hem in and pen in the anti-fascists that were down on the streets below, in full sight of what could have been a massacre directed by these white nationalists down upon the people on the streets.
Do we know how many of these people were up on top of the rooftop?
We don't at this point. And the police has issued conflicting statements. Both the mayor and the police have issued conflicting statements about exactly who and how many people were up on these rooftops and what the status of their weapons were and what the legality of their weapons were, which is a complicated conversation in and of itself. But the fact remains that they had these weapons in a spot overlooking the anti-fascist protest where they could have easily opened fire.
Right, and I've seen several things that have corroborated that they had, quote, long guns, you know, which I assume are semi-automatic rifles, or, you know, some, you know, essentially not handguns. And then also they were saying they were let go because they had concealed weapons permits, which I don't know what that has to do with having a long gun. I mean, you can't conceal a long gun.
Yeah, the legality of open carry in Portland is super complicated, and really, I don't think anybody understands it completely, except for the police, who just seem to release whatever sort of dictates they want about what is legal and what isn't legal at any particular place and time. Additionally, the police and mayor statements have differed on exactly what might have made those weapons legal, whether they were loaded or unloaded, what kind of weapons they were, where they were in relation to the people, which is kind of all the you know, the various loopholes regarding the gun laws that exist in Portland and Oregon.
Yeah, I just want people to take a moment and really appreciate how messed up the situation was. I mean, you had a mass mobilization. I mean, it was, you know, labor unions, you know, nonprofits, the DSA, like anarchist groups. I mean, there was a huge popular mass mobilization that came out to, you know, push back against, you know, Joey Gibson, who at the time was running for Senate in a different state and had brought, you know, by and large, an entire group of people from outside of the area. And the police attacked, almost killed people with weapons, using the excuse that they themselves had bottles thrown at them, which, you know, everyone from, you know, the mainstream corporate reporters on the ground to Unicorn Riot filming, you know, all corroborated that that was not true, that that was a lie. And then at the same time, you have a group of far right white nationalist militia types that are on roofs, you know, potentially ready to kill people, putting people's lives in danger. And not only that, but the police didn't even tell people. And my next question is, why are they bringing this forward now? Are they worried that it's going to come out?
Well, the thing that the mayor is trying to do is he's trying to implement this ordinance that would create some sort of free speech zones downtown. Basically, this would give them the police the ability to herd people into separate zones and keep them separate from each other in contentious protest situations or other times where they feel like it's necessary to separate different groups of protesters from each other. But they use this instance of the weapons cache as kind of, I guess, to try and make people more afraid, to try and emphasize the danger that exists. And while we definitely don't want to downplay the danger that exists, the thing that's ridiculous from our perspective is that what they basically want to do, what this ordinance is it's a plan to hem in anti-fascist protesters so that they can more easily be shot, is really what they want to do. And that's what we saw happen on August 4th. The Portland police constrained where the anti-fascist march was able to go, and in fact kept them closed into an area where there were armed white nationalists looking over them with an easy shot down on upon them. And then the police themselves opened fire. So in this situation with this proposed ordinance, it's hard to say who exactly will be the ones able to take the shot on anti-fascists first, but the cops and the white nationalists will be able to apparently work together to determine exactly where and when they keep the anti-fascist side penned in and be able to exact, violence, surveillance, arrest upon any of them at any time. So obviously we're completely against this thing. We find it to be outrageous and to be a continuation of the police working in conjunction with the white nationalist side with and helping them enable their events and more easily have this violence come into our downtown, just like we saw on August 4th.
Yeah, not only that, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It says, like, if two groups are going to rally at the same time and they have any sort of history of violence, I mean, what about the fact that the Proud Boys have gone out and attacked members of the community time and time again? I mean, somebody like Tiny has... And some of these other characters have gone to local malls or just on the street and attacked people and beat them up. And, they seem to have no recourse.
Yeah, what we see from the mayor here is him falling back again on this kind of both sides discourse, as this portrayal that there are two sides here, white nationalists and anti-fascists, and according to him and the police, these sides are basically evil, even. But in fact, that's obviously not true. There's no neutrality that you can hide behind when you're talking about the way that white nationalists seek violence on the streets as a political tool. That is in no way equivalent to the sort of self-defense that's organized by communities in order to protect themselves from this sort of violence. And we can look at this in terms of both the ideology of the different groups, but also the very specific evidence. As you mentioned, the Proud Boys have been out attacking people not at rallies. They come down to rallies like the Patrick Kimmons vigil in order to look for people to attack. They look for situations where they can get a few people that they find vulnerable, and then they can attack them and beat them down. That's what we saw in New York with them screaming homophobic things while they beat down three people by a crowd of 30. This is what that side is. That's what white nationalism is. And the anti-fascist protests, on the other hand, looks like a bunch of different community groups. It looks like, as you were saying before, nonprofits, socialist groups, union groups, all kinds of groups that are focused on nonviolence and police accountability coming together, some of them definitely blocked up for their own safety against white nationalists and the police, but many of them not. We see a broad coalition of people coming down to these events in Portland, and this both sides rhetoric on behalf of the mayor tries to make it look like that broad coalition of people organized for their defense of their city and for what's ethical and what's right in society is somehow equivalent to a mob of people beating down people in the streets screaming homophobic taunts and slurs.
Also, just, you know, in kind of closing, I would imagine that a lot of civil liberties groups, you know, are not going to take kindly to this this proposal. I mean, this is a massive attack on, you know, people's basic rights. I've already seen some stuff by the ACLU denouncing this. Is there plans to fight this, or what is the next step for this proposal? Does it have to be voted on, or?
I believe it is going to the before the city council this week for debate, and then I assume an initial vote. I also imagine that there will indeed be legal challenges to it. The ACLU has been at the forefront of those legal challenges already here in Portland. They organized a civil suit against the Portland police for their actions in corralling anti-fascist protesters at a different protest incident that was June 4th, 2017. Another incident where they attempted to enforce these sorts of de facto free speech zones, and the ACLU is already in the process of suing them for breach of civil liberties and people's rights in that situation. So I imagine they will be on this one too. As far as we're concerned, as far as Rissity Antifa is concerned, we're not going to allow this to stop us from organizing to defend our community. We remember the victims of Proud Boy violence. We remember the victims of the murders that happened here in 2017 on the MAX train that was perpetrated by one of Joey Gibson's followers. We know the threat that the white nationalists pose to our community, and that is something that we will not relent in fighting. Regardless of whether they adopt this ordinance or not, we're going to continue to organize and do what we can to make our city safer and keep these white nationalists out of it. And we believe that the city, who has joined us on numerous occasions in the past in doing so, feels the same way.
You know, last question. Looking back at the skinhead and neo-Nazi, you know, the skinhead, bonehead neo-Nazi violence of the late 1980s and early 90s, a lot of people have drawn a parallel, and I'm just curious. I mean, I think a lot of people just continuously seeing these groups come out. I mean, a lot of people have made the point now that at this point, I mean, they're not even necessarily trying to get a political point across. I mean, these are gangs, and they're excited about violence. They want to engage in violence. They want to hurt people. This is why a lot of these people are coming out to these events to engage in violence. I'm just curious. I mean, any hopeful kind of things you can say about just the path ahead? I mean, looking at the past, how does that compare to what's playing out now? Is this going to be a long, bitter struggle that's going to take years to get these guys off the streets, or are you seeing any sort of positive turnaround in the near future?
I think making any kind of accurate predictions about the future is a pretty difficult thing to do. However, you know, the thing that does encourage me is seeing how, regardless of the sort of closed eye approach that the mayor has and this condoning attitude that the Portland police has, the people themselves, the people of the community who live here in Portland have been very clear in their determination to not allow their streets to be given over to these sorts of violent white nationalist gangs. I think the people here in Portland know what's right and wrong, unlike the mayor and the police, and they're going to continue to fight no matter what. And I think that's really going to be the thing that turns the corner and lets these groups know that they can't come in here and attack people and get away with it. People are not going to just turn away and look the other direction and ignore this violence that they're bringing into the community.
Thank you so much for talking with us, and best of luck out in Portland.
Thanks very much.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.